Hello, and welcome to 15-Minute History. This season, John and I are going to bring you the stories of heroes in history and the lessons they teach us today. If this is your first time here, we're glad to have you. Stay connected with us at our website, 15minutehistorypodcast.org, where you can find transcripts, older episodes, and our contact form, or on Facebook and Instagram. Now, let's start the show.
This season has been about heroes in history. By sharing a few of their stories, we hope you will remember the bravery of those who came before and be reminded that heroism is not reserved for the famous or well-funded, and that heroes can be anyone who, in the face of conviction, decides that might is not always right.
To drive this home, we close out the season by interviewing those who voluntarily go into professions that we naturally take for granted until we need them. Some of these professions are dangerous, others are gross and uncomfortable, still others are thankless. Those that choose such careers are a different breed of person, and as we end the season, we want you to hear from them, to listen to their stories, and to understand that no matter where you are surrounded by such heroes every day.
This will be a two-part episode broadcast this week and next. In them, we will speak with an advanced EMT, a nurse, a Marine, and a school administrator. None of these individuals are famous. They do not have YouTube channels or millions of followers, but each one has made a lasting impact on many lives in their communities, and we want you to hear their authentic stories. So enjoy. I am really excited to welcome back to the podcast a friend of ours, Mr. Dan Lindsay. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me again, John.
Great to have you on this closer for season six of 15-Minute History.
I've enjoyed the season a lot.
Good. I'm glad. I want to start by giving you the opportunity to kind of tell a little bit of your background to kind of set the stage for this conversation.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dan Lindsay. I am a father of three and husband to my wife, Leah. I spent 8 years in the United States Marine Corps as a reservist, and I am a business owner and entrepreneur as well in the logistics world. So that's the 80,000-foot view.
No, that's perfect. So with this season being about heroes, I wanted to get the perspective of some people who are making a difference in their communities about their work and about how it impacts other people and kind of the qualities that they see in others who are heroes. I guess to start off, Dan, I want to get your thoughts on specifically your profession as an entrepreneur, as a business owner. What interested you enough to pursue it and to do what you do on a daily basis now?
The industry in general or entrepreneurship?
Well, that's a good question. I will let you answer that question however you or cover that however you want.
Gotcha. Because it's kind of two different answers. So
yeah.
The logistics industry has always fascinated me because the way I've always described it is it's a Rubik's Cube that's never able to be solved. It's this great unsolvable puzzle, and everybody's trying to fit the next piece in the supply chain, in the efficiency models, in the transportation and distribution networks. Everybody's trying to find that next piece that fits. But as soon as you find that next piece that fits, there are four or five others that manifest themselves and get in the way of the problem being completely solved. And so that's always fascinating. I mean, I've loved solving problems. Also, when I was in the Marine Corps, one of the required readings for NCOs was Karl von Clausewitz's treatise on war.
Mm.
And one of the things that fascinated me was his opinion on the indispensable nature of two different roles in the military. One was communication and one was logistics. And his position was basically, if you want to destroy an army most efficiently, take out their communication and take out their logistics.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I took away from that is communication and logistics are indispensable components of any military. And I extend that to the economy. And so when thinking about the career choices that I've made, you know, in an effort to provide for my family, I want to be in an industry that is pretty essential to the economy so that I can guarantee that there will always be a job for me in my field. So that's what drew me to logistics. Also, my dad was a truck driver for 30 years, so I kind of already spoke the language.
Okay.
in terms of entrepreneurship, I've always kind of been a self-starter, I guess, and marched to the beat of my own drum. And one of the things that I found, at least in my experience in corporate America, was that if you were an outside-the-box thinker, you were a threat.
Hmm.
Now, that is not necessarily the case anymore, I don't think. But when I was just starting out in my career in the early 2000s, that was very much my experience. Whereas if you have new ideas, if you want to change things up, if you want to approach and tackle problems in a way that has not been done before, you are a threat to the middle management that is above you. You're not a threat to the C-suite, because they love that stuff.
Right.
They love outside-the-box thinking. They love, you know, new ideas, fresh perspectives. They love that. But when it comes to middle management, they want to take credit for those ideas. And so if you have those ideas as an entry-level employee, you are a threat to them. Hmm. And so they don't always pass your ideas up. And so I got tired of having good ideas, or what I thought were good ideas, and having them get stuck in the hierarchy of corporate America. And so when I went to go work in the freight brokerage world in 2013, I was pretty much able to run my own book of business the way I wanted to run my own book of business. And I left that company in 2019 because of some internal issues, some cultural issues, and the way they treated people I didn't agree with. And I was actually out of logistics. I went into the consulting world for a year, was operating under a much slower pace, got reacquainted with my family, which is good. But ultimately, logistics is one of those things where once you get the bug, you always try and find a way back, it seems, into the fray. And so when I started Linkage with my business partner in 2020, it was under the premise that I've seen freight brokerages and companies operating, in my opinion, the wrong way. If we're going to build this, I need 100% autonomy to build it the way I know it needs to be built.
Hmm.
That was my one and only caveat to going back into the industry. I wanted to be able to do it my way. So that was how I got back into the industry, and it's been a roller coaster ever since.
Yeah, I'm sure. Especially you started it in 2020,
March 1st.
Oh wow! I think I remember you. Yeah, you mentioned that, but boy, that was an auspicious time to get involved in moving stuff from point A to point B.
Yeah, we, like 14 days in, my partner and I had a meeting, a very stress-filled, tense meeting, basically asking, what are we going to do? And my answer was, I don't know what you're going to do. I'm going to put my head down and get to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because to use the Navy SEALs official motto, the only easy day was yesterday. So let's go.
Exactly. I want to get your perspective with three different hats on this one. As a business owner, as a parent, and when you were in the Marine Corps, how would you define a hard day, a difficult day? You mentioned the only easy day was yesterday, the SEALs term. I don't want to build on that. What is a hard day as a logistics expert, as a parent, and as a Marine?
I will answer that briefly, and then I'll dig into it a little bit. I don't think there are easy days. I think if you're having an easy day or easy times, then you're not pushing yourself as much or as far or as hard as you should. This world is hard to navigate. And so I think in the world of logistics, I mean, things are constantly moving. And so we have drivers over the road. We have trucks breaking down. We have brokers and team members losing their minds on each other, trying to figure out where shipments are. We have customers calling and demanding answers to questions we don't have answers to at the moment. And so everyone is demanding a lot of us at any point throughout the day. I think one of the most stressful things that can happen, especially in the brokerage world, is when you are aware that you're not meeting your customer's expectations and the next setback happens after you're aware of it. If you're experiencing service issues, and your customer has notified you that you are not delivering per what you said you would deliver, and then the next driver calls in and falls out on your load to take a different load, that's extremely frustrating and disheartening. So that's in freight. I would say, again, building on the premise that there are no easy days, as a parent, and I have to be careful here, because I have been told by by my wife and others that I am a very serious person, borderline probably too serious. I'll own that I am. But one of the reasons I think that is because talking about heroes, right? What do heroes do? Heroes take responsibility for the things that are not necessarily theirs to take responsibility for. Mm. And so what I think when it comes to parenting, in light of that, is that parents take responsibility for every aspect of their children's lives, not only for the benefit of their children, but for the benefit of the future. I'm not just raising my kids. I'm in some way impacting the future of humanity through every interaction with my kids. And so when it comes to whether or not the day has been difficult or hard, I think every day is hard, especially if you walk through it with the mindset, with that mindset. As a Marine, again, every day was hard. And I had it a little differently, a little easier, I think, because I was a reservist. So I was able to take that hat off and put it down for 3 weeks out of the 3 weeks out of the month.
Right.
And then put it back on again. But again, you're always pushing yourself to accomplish the next task, the next goal. And if you're not doing that, if you're filling your life with easy days, not only will you not be living up to the potential that you could be, but you will look back, I think, on your life and regret more than you would had you pushed yourself and had you filled your time with difficult days.
Hmm. Very profound. So, especially the part about parenting.
We'll
see. I don't know that I want to have kids now. My goodness.
Well, that wasn't the goal.
No. But that's so true.
It's a heavy weight. And yeah. And the point of saying that is not to say shirk that responsibility.
Oh, yeah.
Not have,
it's, but it's to say,
hey, embrace it. Embracing the cross. Embrace your suffering. Embrace the difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Take it up voluntarily. And in the process, show your kids and show the world what real responsibility looks like, because that will change the future.
Yeah. I see to a much lower degree all of the heroic work that parents do as a teacher in terms of, you know, dealing with 70, 80 kids over the course of a day and then watching them grow over an entire school year and in some cases over an entire, you know, high school career. Just the amount of work that parents put into shaping these kids. I do my very, 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 very small part in that. But man, I have tremendous respect for parents, and I do view them and you, Dan, as a parent.
Well, don't downplay your role as a teacher. I mean, I'm talking
in comparison to parents. I mean, there's a huge gulf of, you know, because I'm there. I'm with kids 2 hours a week, maybe three.
True.
You got to deal with them for the other. What is that? 24 times 5, quick mental math, minus 3. I can't do it.
I'm not good at math either.
No.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's something I've talked to my kids about is that they have no problem, or I would say minimal problem, obeying their teachers for the 2 hours a day that they are with each teacher or whatever. They have a heck of a time obeying me.
Really? Dad. Your kids are so well-behaved, it seems.
I mean, they are.
You got good kids.
Obeying. Well, thank you. Credit Leah with that. But they.
Is she in the room?
No, she's not. No, but they. There's a level of. And I ask my kids this all the time. Like, you have no problem obeying your teachers. Why is it such a struggle to listen to your father or your mother? Or why do you. You don't talk back to your teachers the way you talk back to your mom and I. Why is that? And because there's an authority structure in school.
True.
That they know has to be obeyed, and at home they can relax and be themselves. So there's actually, you have a really high potential for teachers to have a really profound impact on students, especially over the 10 to 12 years of their school career, to consistently deliver on expectations within that hierarchy of authority. So I think that's extremely valuable. And teachers, I love good teachers, because good teachers are a huge help to parents.
Mm. Building on the whole, talking now more about parenting, but also if you want to bring in your career and your service in the Marine Corps, I want to talk about moments kind of where we look back, because throughout this whole season, we've talked about individuals. Every hero has flaws. I made the point in our last episode about George Patton. You know, every hero has flaws. Don't mistake heroes for saviors. And we all have moments in our lifetime where we look back and we're like, I did not handle that right. I did not address that issue correctly. And we all have moments where you're like, yep, nailed it. That was a good day. That was a good decision, whatever it was. How, as a parent, would you define both like a successful day or a successful parenting moment and an unsuccessful one? Kind of more broadly than, oh, I yelled at my kids when I shouldn't have. But like, I guess in a way that where on reflecting, you were like, okay, I'm going to take that bad moment and I'm going to grow from it. And I'm going to take that good moment and I'm going to repeat it as often as I can.
Well, I think that piece is key to understanding what a successful and an unsuccessful moment is. Because I think as a parent or as an individual or a business owner or a service member or whatever you are, if you take an unsuccessful moment and you learn from it, that unsuccessful moment then becomes a successful moment.
Mm.
That to me, I don't believe in failure. Failure is only failure if you do not learn from it. So my first venture into entrepreneurship is something that still can cloud conversations within my household. I did everything wrong. I jumped too soon. I did not plan. I did not consult others. I did not listen to the counsel of my wife. I went it alone and fell hard, flat on my face. And it was probably the most difficult 3.5 years of my entire life. I know that. But there were lessons in there to learn from. And so I think taking those lessons and gleaning what you can from them is very important. When it comes to parenting, I think the thing that I've learned most from parenting is before you can parent someone else, you need to make sure you are teachable.
Hmm.
If I look at things that get in the way of me being an effective parent and me being an effective business owner, it's my own stubbornness and my own narrow-mindedness in thinking that my way is not only the best way, but the only way to do things. And I have to be willing to listen to not only my wife, but my employees as well, because they do have better ideas than I do. I don't have a corner on the market of good ideas,
mm-hmm.
despite how much I tell myself I do. So I think every time I get an opportunity to be corrected is a hard day, a moment where I feel like I have failed, but it's also an opportunity to learn from that mistake and grow. A lot of people, especially parents, they spend so much time parenting their kids that they don't continue to develop themselves. I think that is a huge mistake because you cannot effectively parent your children unless you are continuing yourself to grow. I think every parent, myself included, falls into that trap because you're so focused on making sure that the kids don't die or making sure that that they don't become socially awkward or they don't become instances an embarrassment to you or to the family. But a big piece of that is you as a parent becoming a better person, growing in your faith, in your character, in your responsibility levels, so that you can tackle parenting with more confidence. And your children see that because children are simply barometers. My wife says that all the time. Children are barometers. You can tell the state of someone's household by looking in the eyes of their children. They're a mirror and they reflect whatever is going on at home. And so if you want to know how your parenting is doing, look in the eyes of your kids. Find out how anxious they are. Find out how many things scare them and find out how many solutions or how few solutions as a parent you've brought to the table to address those issues, those anxieties, those fears. So
I think that's right on. I think that for a lot of people, that's the best way that they can be heroes in their community. Something else we've been talking about again throughout this whole season, you know, start at home, start with your kids. If you have children, you're shaping new minds, you're impacting future generations. And there's a lot of stuff in our world today that's pulling kids in all sorts of different directions, some good, some bad, some malign, some not. And mm-hmm. I don't envy parents who have to have those kinds of conversations with their kids about, oh, well, I just learned in school or just saw on TikTok such and such.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, well, and that brings up an important point. One of the things that my wife and I have sought from early on is we operate under the premise of the first person to have the conversation owns it. We were thinking about that in light of having the talk with our older two girls. we were trying to determine when was the appropriate time to have the talk with them and with our son later on. And we determined that sooner was better than later, because if we waited until later to have that conversation with them, their friends have already owned the conversation for a year or two. And so whatever we then teach them is going to be viewed through the lens of whatever their friends or TikTok, God forbid, has shared with them. And this is a lesson, I think, in courage as a parent. Own the conversations. You want to be a hero to your kids? Own the conversations. Have the hard conversations fast. Have them early. Because if you have the conversation with them, especially if you have it in a way that is teaching, instructive, conversational, and not full of the conflict that is typical between parents and children, if you have that conversation in a productive way, not only do you build trust in that area with your kids, you build trust in general with your kids, and the relationship that you have with your kids becomes much more deeply rooted in trust than in conflict. Because there's a lot of conflict in parenting, in parent-child relationships.
Yeah.
Most of our day is, hey, don't do that. Hey, why are you doing that? Hey, stop that. It seems. But if you have the opportunity to sit down and share with your kids proactively, hey, this is something valuable that you're going to have to learn to navigate literally all of life, and I want to share it with you. That's powerful.
Yeah, that is, man. I want to dig so much deeper into this, but it's a history podcast, but man.
Yeah, spin off a philosophy podcast.
Well, yeah, there's so much to that, but in the interest of respecting your time, I will forego the many follow-ups that I have, but we might have to have you back on maybe for a summer special or something like that later this summer to talk more through Dan's philosophy of parenting. Audience members, if you would like to hear that, send us a note and we will get Dan back on in studio instead of over Zoom to do a conversation about that. So Dan, you are a serious student of history. Who are some men and women in the past who you look at as your own personal heroes, and why?
That is a very good question. I think my personal heroes in history are people who understood their place, not just in the moment that they lived, but they understood their place in the moment in the continuum of time historically. And I'll kind of unpack that with an example. I'm reading through currently, very slowly, Andrew Roberts' biography of Churchill.
Masterpiece.
And masterclass in biography writing, in storytelling, just a phenomenal work. And I want to make no bones about it. Churchill was a very flawed human being. At the same time, his life was full of, call it failures, or setbacks, or wrong decisions that he then learned from. In fact, I think he's, one of my favorite quotes from Churchill is that success is moving from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm.
Yep.
I love that quote. I live by that quote more so than I think I realize. But he was an example of someone who knew who he was. He knew the time in which he lived, and he was able to recognize the threat of Nazi Germany long before anybody else, because he was a student of history. He knew historically how things played out, and he could not only, because if you study history, you can understand the future. Mm-hmm. So I think he was able to grasp what would happen in the future if this tyranny from Germany would have been able to take hold in Europe. I think he saw that. I think he saw it vividly, and I think he saw it vividly enough where he was able to communicate the danger effectively that mobilized an entire hemisphere of the globe to act. Slowly but surely. And oftentimes kicking and screaming. But I think that being able to know where you are at your place in time and how your life impacts the future generations of your country, I think that is what heroes do. So, yeah, I have a lot of heroes in history. It's really hard to narrow them down, but I think all of them can be encapsulated in that one thought. I think of Patton. More so than Patton, I love Omar Bradley. Mm-hmm. He's actually, I appreciate him more as a leader than I do Patton.
Really?
Yes, because Patton had the awe and the respect of his men.
Mm-hmm.
Omar Bradley was loved by his men.
Very true.
There's a very different leadership dynamic. And in fact, I think Omar Bradley turned down a command because he wanted to stay as Patton's number two to kind of temper him.
Hmm.
I think that is a true example of leadership and heroism. People always want to define heroes as the ones who run first toward the conflict, and they are. But more so than that, heroes are the ones that put themselves on the line no matter the danger.
Hmm.
And the danger might be facing, in the case of Audie Murphy, thousands of enemy combatants with literally no one else to help you.
Yep.
And everything around you is on fire. And you figure, oh, see, fine. Mm-hmm. let's go. If I'm going to go, we're going to go out in memorable fashion here. Or it could be someone saying, you know what? I'm not going to take that command because I have a responsibility. I'm not going to advance myself right now because I have a responsibility to finish here.
Hmm.
That's, I think, equally heroic and equally self-sacrificing in the long run.
Well said. I agree. So bringing it back to kind of the more, not mundane, but the here and now rather than the past, even though this is a history podcast, the people that you work with, the people you interact with on a daily basis, what character traits do you see in them that you would classify as heroic or as examples of heroism? I assume that your wife would qualify as a hero. I certainly hope so.
100%. She has to deal with me 24/7. Anybody with that kind of strength, God help him. And he does. So I'll take three perspectives. One, from perspective of work and linkage and transportation. I have two guys. Actually, I'm gonna say there's three people at Linkage that I would classify as heroic. Alan, Matt, and Leah, my wife, actually. Because during COVID, we did not know what was going to happen. We did not know how logistics was going to play out. But every single one of those individuals took the initiative and got to work. We took a company with zero customers, zero revenue, zero freight under management, and we built it to, at the end of the year in 2020, we had ran $1.5 million worth of freight. Wow. With about a dozen customers. And then on top of that, the next year, they continued to do that. I mean, Leah herself spent, I think, some weeks she would spend 12 to 14 hours a day on our accounting, on our billables, our AR, on settling out payments with carriers, making sure we were in compliance. I know our brokers spent at least 12 to 14 hours a day, you know, looking after our customers' loads. And they did that with little to no guidance from me.
Hmm.
They simply owned their job. They owned their task. And in many respects, they owned things that were not their responsibility. Leah did not have to come and work for Linkage, but she saw the need and she offered at great personal sacrifice to come and work for Linkage because she knew we needed somebody that we could trust in that role for a time. And so that's from Linkage's perspective and from business, our team has, through the years, and as we've continued to grow, they've grown. Linkage, shameless plug here, we were just named by the Indiana Business Journal the fastest growing private company in Indiana.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations. And that's awesome.
Yeah. And that's not a tribute to, and I told the team this, that's not a tribute to my genius, mm-hmm. or to my partner's genius. That's a tribute to all of your hard work. You guys earned that just as much, if not more, than I did. We earned that as a team. And everyone needs to be proud of that because everyone owns a piece of that. And we're going to do it again, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Because we have a great team. And if you want to join our team, we are hiring agents. If you want to be a freight broker, if you want to own your own destiny, as it were, we will train you. We will educate you in the ways of freight. And we will definitely be open to taking people on. So
nice. How do people who are interested in partnering with you, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah. So if you're a carrier, you can email carrierservices@linkagelogistics.com and get set up with us in 5 minutes. We'll send you our My Carrier Packets link. Truckers know what that is. And then as an agent, if you want to come on as a broker, you can email me. My email address is dlindsey, LINDSEY, @linkagelogistics.com. And I'd be happy to to sit down with you. And even if you're not in Indiana, we do have a couple of agents who are remote. I mean, we have one team member in Dallas and another one we're bringing on in Alabama. So we are a nationwide company. Something else as well, this is a little less known, but this year, me and some industry colleagues are putting on a conference in Tampa, Florida in October. It's called the Broker Carrier Summit. If you are a truck driver or a dispatcher and you are looking for brokers to partner with, I would recommend strongly you join us in Tampa for the Broker Carrier Summit. We should have between 300 and 500 different companies represented there, all that have freight or who are looking to partner with companies that have freight. If you are tired of being taken advantage of by brokers and being treated like garbage, come to the summit and form relationships face-to-face with people who will not treat you like garbage. And if you're a broker and you are looking to grow your network of carriers who are going to be reliable and not steal your customers' loads and not commit fraud, then join us at the Broker Carrier Summit in Tampa, and you will be able to take advantage of that.
Nice.
But then, so when it comes to personal heroism in my life, obviously my wife takes the trophy for that. And no, she's not in the room. Personal story here. So when Leah and I were dating, one of the earliest conversations we had is what we were looking for in a spouse. And I looked at her and I said, I'm looking for someone that I can be a team with and someone that I can trust to have my back, because I will absolutely have theirs. And that's kind of been the modus operandi of our relationship, is I have her back and she knows it, and she has my back and I know it. And from knowing myself, having my back is not always easy, not by a long shot. So anybody who can handle that and embrace it voluntarily, continually, every day, that is the epitome of heroic in my mind.
And in the military, was there any additions there? Or is that kind of the standard? Greater love has no man than this, than he laid down his life for his friend.
I agree with that. And that quote is true. However, and I'm going to say something controversial.
Oh, boy.
Sorry. Just because you wear a shirt or you have a rank,
oh boy,
it doesn't mean you're a hero. I knew plenty of people in the military who were absolute heroes and who I would jump in a foxhole next to if it was only us two. Mm-hmm. I also knew some selfish SOBs who were not heroes in my mind and who will never convince me otherwise. Again, being a hero is not about what uniform you wear. It's about what you do. Mm. But that being said, I'll tell this story too. So I was never deployed as a Marine. 8 years in the Marine Corps, never deployed. Figure out how that works.
In the early 2000s, when we had quite a few Marines downrange.
Right, yeah. 05 to 13. Like, there was no shortage of opportunities.
Oh, wow.
So I volunteered for 4 deployments. And for various reasons, none of those deployments ever ended up working out. The 5th deployment possibility came up in January 2009. And it was going to be a double pump to Iraq and to Afghanistan.
Boy.
Yeah, and I was down for it. The challenge was, I was one of 3 Marines in the reserves, and I think only a handful more in the entire Marine Corps who was trained on a specific piece of equipment. The other 2 in the reserves were my best friends in my platoon. And they jumped on the deployment first because we were having complications with Leah's pregnancy. And so I was kind of vacillating a little bit on whether or not I should volunteer for it. They both jumped on it and volunteered right away. And I tried to get on a couple of weeks later and there were no spots. And I kept pushing to try and get on. And the Marine Corps, being the machine that it is, sometimes is indecisive. 1 week I was on the deployment, the next week I was off. 1 week I was on, the next week I was off. And that happened for 3.5 months. Wow. Which did not lessen the stress on my wife and on her pregnancy. And so I finally got to the point of saying, look, listen, you guys either make a decision right now or just tell me no. Mm-hmm. Because what I'm not going to do is go through the next month of workup on and off. And then the last minute, the last day before we leave, say, hey, get a phone call and say, hey, Lindsay, your number's up. Mm-hmm. And I had to say goodbye to my wife with one day of prep time. Mm-hmm. I can't do that. I'm not going to do that. Fast forward. So they deployed, went to Iraq, went to Afghanistan. Everybody came back, thankfully.
Good.
I was sitting down in a bar with my buddies about a year after they got back. And we were just kind of talking about that story. And my buddy Ryan, who I'm still friends with today, said, hey, I have a confession to make. Justin and I fought very, very hard to block you from that deployment. Really? And I said, why? I was pissed. Huh. I was mad. I said, why? Why would you do that? And they looked at me and they both said, because we saw what you were going through and your family needed you here. That's a hero. Someone who stood in my way and volunteered to go into a hostile environment in my place so that I could be home with my family.
Wow.
So
that's incredible.
Now I'm going to drink a beer.
I don't know where to go from that. I was really hoping this story had a happy ending. They all came home and all of that. And it's like, oh, geez.
Well, they did all come home.
Yeah. But wow. Well, I appreciate you sharing that story. I don't know how to wrap it up from there. Well, thanks, Dan. Appreciate you being on. Jeez. Well, that's one heck of a story. I don't really know where to go from there, but I mean, we've kind of reached the end of our time here. I guess I want to extend my thanks to you as always for taking time to be on the show. We've gotten comments saying that, you know, people really enjoy it when you're on 15 Minute History. So thank you for sharing your perspectives and for sharing that story. That was really something.
No, thank you. It's a privilege to come on. I enjoy it every time.
We're excited to welcome Emily Cochran to 15 Minute History Day. We're really excited to get her perspectives here in this episode about heroes and heroism. So welcome, Emily. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I have a unique background. I started out after college attending nursing school and worked on a cardiac ICU for about 4 years. At the same time, I actually had been working at a program called North Point Homeschool Classes that provides homeschool classes for students in the Indianapolis area. And so after about 4 years in nursing, I stepped into a full-time role at North Point. So I've been in education, honestly, on and off for close to 19 years, but in a full-time capacity for about the past 6 years.
Okay. So was there a correlation in your mind, between nursing? Because that is, as you said, an interesting background between nursing and education. What brought you into education from nursing?
Sure. It's a great question. I get that a lot because it does seem like something that's a unique transition. But for me, I knew from a young age that I wanted to do something I've always considered myself kind of the caregiver role. I did youth ministry, loved serving people, and was always fascinated with science and medicine and all of that. And so entering nursing made sense to me. I actually thought I would do labor and delivery and ended up in the ICU. And honestly, I think a lot of the things that I learned in the ICU about the life or death circumstances, jumping in, it really created the skills that were necessary for me to do in education in a leadership role, because communication is so important, being assertive is so important. And I really found that boldness of advocating for people in the hospital setting, which then allowed me entering education to feel like I had a voice to advocate for students and families at that point. And so that's really what, you know, I got to a point where I was part-time nursing and part-time education and just felt called to switch over.
What aspects of education are kind of the drivers that get you up out of bed every day? What drove you to pursue this educational career?
I think, again, a correlation with nursing is that the whole person. So in the hospital, we would see people who came in with maybe one specific problem, but that represented so many things about their life. And so with a student, really, it's the same thing. You think in education, I'm just worried about making sure that they have the right classes, that the teachers who we hire are equipped to educate them well, and that the students, you know, are successful. But in reality, if we don't address the whole person child, then we are missing something. And so the ability to look at it differently was fascinating to me. Like, look at a system and the way that it's done traditionally and lean into the kind of hybrid model that we do is something that was a passion of mine for a long time, because students need to realize that, you know, if they're successful, what is success? Is it a 4.0 or is it improvement? You know, is it them doing their best at what they've been gifted to do? And so that's something to me that every day getting to realize that every task that I do, like the little things that people don't even see behind the scenes, all play a role in bringing it together to create the environment that each student needs.
This season here on 15 Minute History, we've been talking about heroes and heroism and what defines a hero. And one of the common threads through all these episodes has been challenges. You know, heroes, they have to overcome serious challenges, whether it's in a war or it's in medicine or whatever scenario they're in. What are kind of the biggest challenges as a school administrator in your job? And how would you define kind of a hard day?
Yeah, I always make the joke that, you know, as hard as my day gets at school, at least no one's dying. But that's a morbid joke that I make only because that's what I saw in medicine. But at the same time, I think probably the most difficult day for me is when you're in a position of leadership and you kind of have a pulse on everything that you're doing, from the decisions that you make, the reasons why, like understanding what may be in the best interest of a student, staff person, et cetera, and having to make decisions that you know are the right thing to do, but communicate them in a way that whoever your audience is understands, knowing that there's sometimes a level of a consequence. Maybe it's a disciplinary issue. We might have to make a hard choice with staff or just changing the way that we do something, understanding it may be for everyone, but they don't all get it. And so for me, the most challenging thing is to kind of have your intentions or just, I don't know, what you're trying to accomplish questioned, because not everyone understands the position you're in. And so trying to communicate the reasons why, while still acknowledging and understanding the position that someone else is coming from, can be really difficult. So it can feel kind of isolating is probably the biggest challenge. When you go home knowing that you've done the best that you can, but because you're in a leadership role, it's easy for people to look at you and say, well, why did you do it this way? You don't understand where I'm coming from. So I think trying to draw a line and parallel my experience at the bedside, which was kind of the lowest of the low, up to being in leadership has helped, because I can bring that perspective of, no, I've really been there where I've been under the leadership of someone else, and understanding that sometimes they make decisions I didn't fully understand. So now has given me kind of an empathy towards people in general and thinking through really just perspectives.
What have been some of the biggest challenges you faced as a school administrator? Is it more about communication? Have there been moments where you're just like, man, I don't know what to do. I'm not sure how to address whatever situation has arisen, and what has gotten you through those moments?
Yeah, I think it's changed for sure. I mean, years ago, the challenges that we faced are different than now. I think everyone can agree that across the board, really in various career paths, we're dealing with seeing mental health challenges with students, isolation, anxiety, social media. Some of the things that are challenging our students have changed, and that makes it very difficult in leadership to kind of keep a pulse on what's going on with a student and address those challenges. And there are definitely times that we've paused and said, okay, what is the best path here? How do we address this? And keeping the traditional biblical values we were founded on as a program, but also addressing what's happening with students. And that has been very challenging because not everybody agrees. You know, the end point may be the same, but the method of getting there has to be considered very carefully in a program like ours. And so I would say that's really probably the biggest challenge for me is when you know what the kind of the end goal is, but it's difficult to get there. And yeah, we've seen it all in our program. We've seen students struggling greatly with mental health and depression, anxiety, suicidality, to just the everyday teen angst and what you deal with, to academic concerns, and trying to partner well and taking care of the whole program when also considering the individual can sometimes be a contrast that's really challenging.
In an interview that I did yesterday, I talked with somebody who
made the point about when it comes to education, when it comes specifically to teachers, the importance of having conversations early, having conversations first, not letting the world and not letting students' friends deal with or set the agenda when it comes to questions of sexuality or it comes to questions of morality or whatever it is. Be the first people to have that conversation. How do you encourage or do you encourage teachers to have those kinds of conversations, those kinds of difficult conversations in a partnership environment? Or is it, in your view, do you leave that more to the parents?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think this is something that has kind of shifted where you want to partner well. I mean, if you have a student who's gained a level of trust with you as an educator and they come to you and want to talk, it's very challenging to navigate that conversation and not feel like you're shutting them down mm-hmm. and feel like you're appealing to what the administration wants. And so we want to try and balance. So we're really kind of shifting to better communicate upfront to our families what it is that we stand for, who we are as a program, what our values are, where we're coming from. So they know from the very beginning for difficult conversations like sexuality that here's where we stand as a program. So if your student does bring something up to this is the lens, the biblical lens we're always going to respond with, but we're also going to keep you in the loop. We're going to tell you, you know, this is that partnership means that if a student comes to us and shares something that we feel like the parent needs to know, we're going to carefully share that and support the family as a whole. And so, I mean, our teachers are incredible. They are experienced in education, but they also love the Lord. They love their students. And so they play an integral role in the discipleship of students through being a safe place for students to talk to. And sometimes, you know, students are walking that they're growing as a person and they're trying to figure out, okay, I've always heard this from my parents or my church or my wherever I work. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to kind of develop their worldview. And so our perspective as educators is that it's our job to teach them how to be learners, to have a love for learning and to realize that there is absolute truth. And of course, we are a Christian program, so we want that to be founded in biblical truth. But at the same time, it matters to me that a student believes those things or has a foundation because they have asked the tough questions and had those conversations. And so I think it's important to be constantly evaluating that. I don't think it's fair to ever say the way we do it's the right way or the way they mm-hmm. do it. I think it's just so important to constantly reevaluate motivation and just your own. You know, am I asking these students thought-provoking questions or am I imposing something on them, even if it's the right thing? You know, am I giving them an opportunity to ask questions and feel safe doing that? Because mm-hmm. the world is, they're telling them that whatever they believe is true is fine. You know, that's their truth. And so to us, that defies the logic that we're trying to teach them. And so we want them to have an answer to the questions that are asked of them and to have a safe place to navigate how to create their own belief system, really, and to be able to defend it.
Yep. It sounds like the key to success in education from your perspective is good communication. What are your thoughts, not to get political or anything like that, but just the current trend in education, not just here in the United States, but around the world, where it's kind of teachers are being set against parents rather than a partnership, where you're seeing teachers hide information from parents. How should parents who are now facing this kind of situation, if their kids are in public school, in your mind, how should they address that? Aside from just leaving the school and going to an alternative like North Point, if that's not an option to them.
Sure. It's a very valid point because not only are we not geographically located next to every single family, mm-hmm. but we have a cost associated. And so that's something that we war with is we want to be an alternative, but we also don't want to, you know, pin ourselves against traditional education because you still have to have, there's amazing teachers and administrators in the traditional school setting mm-hmm. who I believe are doing their very best and falling under challenges truly just because of kind of the politics behind it. And I don't even mean that from a political place. It's really just policies and things that they are kind of working against. But what I always challenge parents who are entering the hybrid model for the first time, and then honestly, teachers we hire from traditional setting is just because something has been common to you doesn't make it normal. Just because that's what's been expected doesn't mean that's what's right. And so it should be a given that a parent has a God-given responsibility to be involved in their child's education, but also every area of their life. So children are not adults yet. Like their prefrontal cortex doesn't develop until they're 25 years old. And if that's true and that guides a lot of the other areas of our country and where what guidelines we set in place for children, that parents are told, you know, make sure they wear a car seat, then a seatbelt, make sure that you mm-hmm. are medications and other substances away from them. You know, you can't drink, you can't drive, all of these things until a certain age. It's because we've acknowledged from science that there is an age under which a child really can make the right decision. And so we've been entrusted as their parents. And yes, educators play a huge role in that day to day, especially 5 days a week. That's a lot of time. But unfortunately, teachers in the traditional school setting have seen where they've had to step in ways, because they might have a student who doesn't have a parent doing what needs to be done. They may have a student struggling with something. They don't feel like their home is a safe place to talk about. And that may not feel like the minority of time anymore. That might feel like common. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that doesn't mean that you just in turn say, okay, now every single time someone shares something with me, I can't trust that that home is a safe place. We need to keep kind of the default. Our natural reaction needs to be, this is their family. You know, these are their parents. And it's not my job to assume that this isn't a safe place. It's my job to communicate and then bring in the appropriate resources if necessary. You know, even if I've had difficult conversations where I've had to involve the Department of Child and Family Services, not because I absolutely know there's a concern at home, because I'm legally obligated to report. And then I have to trust that they're going to do their job at that point. And that's part of the purpose as well. But even still, I just think it's important for parents to know it's okay to advocate as the parent with your kids. You know, your expectation, it's okay for your expectation to be transparency and communication. And you should expect that. And so if you're not getting it in the public school system, then you advocate because that's your job and you don't stop. No different than if your child was struggling in the hospital and I tell families to have an advocate medically, you also need to have one academically and understand kind of your rights in education. And if that doesn't work for you and you need to take a step back, there are now, the wonderful thing is there's so many options out there, from programs like ours to free options to online to homeschooling. And I think that it's amazing to see the resources that have come together to allow families to make the choice that is best for their student.
Now, kind of a more personal, more introspective question for you, kind of building on everything that we've been talking about. We all have days where we've, you know, we look back on it and we said, yep, that was a good day. And we all have days where we're like, boy, I did not do the right thing. I screwed that up. In those days, assuming that you have those as a school administrator, how do you reflect on both the good days and the bad days as you go forward for the next day, the next week, the next month?
I think that for me, and I say this a lot when I did youth ministries, I have to give myself the same grace that I ask people to give themselves. So in leadership, if I'm meeting with someone who feels that way, man, I messed up. I didn't do this right. I'm reminding them that they're human, that no one expects them to be perfect. They're fallible. We make mistakes. And what can we learn from this? It develops character. And if I can't apply that to myself, then I'm being disingenuous to the people that I'm leading. And so a lot of times when you do reflect back and realize, for me personally, one of my biggest struggles is saying the hardest part in a conversation, that kind of last 10%. You know, it's I've gotten bold enough through how God's used different experiences in my life to share, but it is, nobody likes to share the last 10%, because so often people assume you're just attacking. And so I will war with myself when I leave thinking, man, how could I have approached that differently? Did I share? Am I doing them a disservice by not saying constructive criticism or giving constructive feedback? And then I remind myself, you are not perfect. You are learning. Look at where you were 10 years ago or 15 years ago compared to now. And what would you tell someone else? And I'll tell students that all the time when they're like, oh, I'm not good enough. I don't have any friends. No one likes me. I could never get an A in this subject. And I'll look at them and say, what would you tell your best friend if they were saying the same thing? And it's so much easier for someone to look at their friend who they care about and say, well, that's not true. That's not who you are. Look at all of the things that are good about you. And they kind of, it usually softens someone and they realize, wow, that's true. Like I've got to step back and take a breath and say, I wouldn't beat myself or, you know, my best friend up that way. So why would I do that to myself? And that slowly starts to create a level of putting yourself in someone else's shoes for yourself first to be reflective. But then all of a sudden it's a lot easier when you see someone else's bad day, because we all experience that, right? Like I can have a bad day where I wish I handled it differently, but we can be on the receiving end of that too. I get reamed as an administrator from students, parents, teachers, staff who don't understand. I'm often the recipient of their worst day. And I can't let that be my worst day, because I've learned to be, you know, self-reflective. And in that I can say, I wonder what happened to them today to make that reaction so strong. I mean, I know this person. I know that's not their heart. So if they were comfortable responding that way to me, they must really be struggling with something. And I think if we, even as a culture, can get to a place where we realize that across the board, I mean, talk about equality, we're all equally just as messed up. We all struggle just as much. And when we get to that place, you can kind of laugh about it a little bit. You can say, goodness, if I started looking at the things that happened to me through the lens of what's happening to someone else, how would that shift my reaction? And when we can teach kids to be teachable, to be humble, and to kind of look at it from someone else's shoes, they can realize, wow, the world isn't out to get me. You know, my family's not out to get me. My teachers aren't out to get me. Everybody has their own experiences. And how can we actually help someone else? And that really takes a huge weight off of what you're struggling with personally. And that, and that for me is what's made the difference. Is, and I saw that in the ICU. I saw people at their worst day. I put people in body bags. I was in a coat and had to go tell a family member their loved one had died.
Oh, and man.
That changed everything for me because I left and it was almost like culture shock. I'd go home and everyone else is talking about their bad day. And I easily could have gotten jaded. Like, how do you think that's a bad day? Like, I had lost an 18-year-old today. How is that a bad day? What you did. But I realized I chose to enter medicine. I chose to enter education. Their reality is their reality. So it's not fair for me to project my bad day on them when they don't even have the same circumstances. It's not, it's comparing apples and oranges. And so that shift really softened. Like my worst day now, I just remind myself of someone else's worst day. And it doesn't discount, doesn't set aside what I might be struggling with. It just gives perspective. Mm-hmm. And when you have perspective, it's a lot easier to get through those rough days.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like every school administrator should have some ICU training to get that, to get that kind of perspective.
It seems so random to people. And yet I cannot even tell you how just the organization, the time management, the task, recognizing what's important, you know, strategizing and essentially triaging, and then getting to the point where you combine that with when it's life or death, you get the boldness to say nicely, no, this is not what needs to happen right now. And so you just get that high level view. And I can't even communicate how much that has meant administratively to me and how many times I reflect back on that time in the ICU and apply some of those skills to what I'm doing now.
In my conversation with Dan Lindsay, we talked about kind of what defines a hero. And he made the point that it's not the uniform you wear, the job that you have, it's the actions that you take. Assuming that you agree with that, and I don't want to assume for you, but what are kind of the characteristics and the actions that people in education, people in nursing, and just more generally from your experience that they can take to be heroes in their own community?
Yeah, I do completely agree. I think it can be so overstated that, you know, you make the assumption, you read on the news about exactly like what he said, the person in uniform, the person in a certain career, that's typically what you hear about. Mm-hmm. And so it can make just your everyday person think, well, I work in this job and there's no way, you know, I'm not a hero. There's nothing I do in my life that could make me be defined as a hero to someone else. When in reality, to me, even in education and medicine, it was the people who were doing things, the kind of the quiet actions behind the scenes, the things that really had an impact in people's lives that weren't necessarily seen. You know, it's not like you're getting an award for going above and beyond with a patient or a student or, you know, a coworker. But I think those are the things that can really have a tremendous impact in people's lives. And going back to the empathy idea of putting yourself in someone else's shoes, when we get to a place where we can see people instead of just, if we only focus on our bad days or our concerns or stressors, we miss all of the opportunities to be someone else's hero as we walk the streets. And so if we're in our workplace and you notice something about someone, say it, say something positive, you know, kind of change the course of what our culture is doing right now by being belittling or keyboard warriors behind the scenes where people just are so bold to say the hard thing, but they're not bold to say something affirming. And so I think what we have is a lot of people walking around with tremendous insecurity and self-doubt look at other people as the heroes or people better than them. And instead, we should be pointing out those things and going above and beyond in different ways. You know, we've got teachers who will take the time to see when a student is struggling, a student who smiles every day and walks in the classroom one day and just looks down. And instead of focusing on, I don't have time, I've got this project in the next class, I only have 5 minutes before I'm with kids all day, they stop and they think, you know what, I'm just going to ask how they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I, as the leader, have heard parents say, you have no idea how much it meant to my kid when they were sick and they got a message from the teacher saying, I'm praying for you. I hope you feel better soon. Now, that is the smallest thing. Most people would not call that being a hero. But for a student who may be struggling with feelings of isolation and self-doubt, thinking that nobody in their life sees them, to have an adult who took that 2 seconds to just write a message to them, it's life-changing. And those kinds of things can literally change the trajectory of a child's life because adults took the time to reach out and see them and help them be known and call out things in a positive way that they've been gifted in when they may be in their minds thinking, I can never be anything. How much more can you define a hero than someone who helps someone become one? You know, if a teacher or a nurse or a person walking on the street or at the grocery store can say something and speak life into someone, and that person then in turn steps up and into the role of an educator or an administrator or a nurse or in the military, then they may be the one you're reading about someday. Mm-hmm. But you want to tell me that every hero story that you read about doesn't have some story that that person would speak to about someone in their life who impacted them? And that's what I think we forget is like the person behind the scenes who paved the way for that individual to become known as a hero may have been the quiet one behind the scenes.
That's so deeply profound. That's such a great perspective. Yeah, you think of, we read about the heroes, the great heroes in history, you know, generals and scientists who cured diseases. And yeah, I mean, they all had their own heroes who shaped who they ended up being. That's such a good perspective, such a history-minded perspective. I love it.
Well, it's different. And it was actually shared with me in relation to the ministry that I'm doing, where someone, you know, so often a lot of the people in these areas, like, you know, we don't just have money, right? You know, I mean, when you're in education or nursing or anything, you're not doing it because it pays you millions of dollars. And so people who are trying to pave the way for something often feel limited based on resources. And so many times in history, there were people behind the scenes who saw someone's gifting and they had wealth and they partnered with that person to advance the cause. And there's so many stories in history. There was an individual who wrote a book called Gospel Patrons, speaking just to that, who, you know, you have no idea that God may have gifted you in a different way. You may have the gift of encouragement or teaching and use that to have an impact on somebody who makes an absolute difference in the world. And that you planted a seed for that. Mm-hmm. It's partly your role. And so absolutely. I mean, is the hero the person on the front lines or is the hero the person who made them that?
Yeah. And that's a good lead into my final question for you. A lot of what I'm hearing from you is about challenging kind of the traditions in education, the traditions in communication, the traditions in how we interact with one another. You know, like just a word of encouragement. I don't think that our society today is built for something like that. Social media certainly is not. And I know that you are involved, not just in education, but in some other areas that are challenging those paradigms. So just as we wrap up our time together, can you tell our audience a little bit about the other opportunities and maybe a way that they can get involved in these kinds? If they are listening to this and they're like, wow, this Emily sounds like someone I would be interested in talking to or in supporting, what can they do? How can they get in touch with you on that?
No, I appreciate that question. You know, it is true. I appreciate how you said that, which is challenging the traditional approach, basically. We've done that for years in education. And now I'm passionate about everything I just said. You know, how can really shift the approach? Because I think as adults, we need it. And as children, they need it. And our next generation is the one at risk if we can't get a handle on some of these things. And otherwise, we're just going to raise an entire generation of people who have been, you know, isolated and attacked behind the scenes and feel insecure. And that's just not conducive to a healthy culture. Mm-hmm. And so really the culmination of all of these passions are in the launch of an online community called Project Revival that's launching this September. And that community is designed to essentially awaken and equip parents and families to this way of thinking, this challenge of thought to say, how can we get the tools, resources, wisdom, in the hands of parents so that they can feel empowered to raise a next generation to love Jesus, to have a strong worldview, and to be so confident in what it is that they are gifted in that they can go use that to change the world. And I think that if we can shift the paradigm, if we can help people come from the perspective of thinking about everybody else, then we really can change the world with that. I think we can change a generation. And I know fully that there are so many individuals, churches, ministries around the country and the world that are working hard in their own way to do this. And so the Project Revival community is designed to connect. You know, everyone says the term divide and conquer, right? Mm-hmm. But to me, it's really, no, we need to combine and conquer. We need to come together and lean into the wisdom and the giftings that we all have been given individually and empower each other to speak life into this next generation. And so that's launching in September. And really, we're looking for people in whatever capacity they've been gifted. I mean, for some people, they're financially supporting so that we can get launched. Some people have a passion that they want to share on our podcast. They want to write content for the blog, or they may have courses that they want to list. We've got really just a variety of ways for people to connect. And we want to connect people to you. So as listeners are listening around the country, you know, it's not limited. This really is that whole person child that I talked about is what we're how we're approaching. And we're excited about it. I think that we want parents to know they're not alone in their desire to have transparent communication, to have a partnership, to feel supported, and to have the resources they need to address some of those very difficult topics that the world is kind of, they're taking their own stride, right? Like they're approaching it on social media and reels.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We want to take the opportunity to say, no, it's okay. We're gonna come together and fight back and provide the resources needed. So it's something I'm very excited about. And I think the more we can connect people together, the more that we can really change the world. And so there's no passion or gifting or story that someone has that we would say no to. So if there's anyone that's passionate about something and they just don't know how to get started, contact me, because we will never say no to putting someone's story out there, because you have no idea how that can impact someone listening.
So how do they get in touch with you? Do you have a website? You said it launches in September.
Yeah, it launches in September. It's projectrevival.com.
Okay.
So they can take a look. And right now there's just an overview about that, and they can reach out through the website and see our email from there, but they can contact us through projectrevival.com.
And it's not geographically limited. So this is not just for people living in Indiana or in the Midwest. This is nationwide, hopefully global eventually.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're actually working on opportunities to connect if families are missionaries abroad and they just want to connect with what it is that they're doing. Essentially, it's internet access and that's it. There's really no limitation to what we're addressing, because as we raise our kids, there's a tremendous number of things that we need help with. And some people are experts in one area and struggling in another. And if we can bring all of those people together, then it all balances out.
All right. Well, thank you for giving up some of your time to talk to us today. You've shared some really awesome perspectives and some great insights in heroism. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
I appreciate the opportunity and always love just sharing the things that God's done in my life personally and what we're doing in the ministry.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for part one of these special hero interviews. Be sure to tune in for part two next week.